thank you for joining us on The Skeptic Sidekick, where we delve into ancient societies, ghosts, the paranormal, UFOs, all looking at it from the perspective of the true believer and from the skeptic perspective. Joining me, my partner, my co-host, my sibling, Kimber Rodriguez. Myself, I am Richard Gregg. And again, let's look into being the skeptic psychic.
Yes, what is really new with you this week? How is your father-in-law? I know everyone's concerned about it.
He's... okay. Let's just leave it at that.
Okay. But doing better?
Doing better.
Yeah, we had some freak storms coming through, and so we were without power Friday for about 8 hours, and then Sunday it went out again, and we were out for quite a few hours, so that's the reason that we are posting tonight. But other than that, glad I have power again. It was getting kind of hot and humid here without power yesterday. And living with candles, it was like, how did people do it back in the days before the internet and all that good stuff? Mm-hmm. Go ahead and start telling us about the feral children.
All right. The talks of Mowgli, Tarzan, as well as, you know, the legends and lore of these such things. We decided we want to discuss a few cases type thing, which we would like to call feral children. Now, legend, according to Roman mythology, there were a set of twins by the name of Romulus and Remus, and no, not to be confused with the Star Trek world. You know, according to accounts of children being abandoned or raised by animals are as ancient as Roman mythology. The first reported feral children were twins of a noble birth who were left to die in the wilderness around 750 BC. According to legend, a she-wolf suckled and protected them. Then, as stories say, a shepherd found the brothers who grew up tending flocks. Eventually, Romulus killed Remus and founded the city of Rome. Now, philosophers and scientists have long speculated nurture versus nature of the origin of language and the power of love. Some saw feral children as the perfect subjects to study. Free of the imprint or influence on humanity, others experiment on baby humans and monkeys. Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor, was determined to discover the language that God would have spoken to Adam and Eve. In 1211, he had orphaned infants rounded up and ordered nurses to suckle and bathe the children, but never speak to them. If the babies grew up in silence, he thought they would speak the original language. But all the infants died. His labor was in vain. A monk named Celandine Adam wrote in his medieval chronicles, "For children could not live without the clappings of the hands and the gestures and the gladness of conference and blandishments," whatever blandishment means.
Yes, that kind of reminds me of the experiment they did in, I think it was Romania, in an orphanage, where they, you know, they showered some children with love and then they ignored the other ones, just giving them their what they needed. And the way that it proved that we as humans need communication, we need, you know, we need for people to pay attention to us and nurture us and love us, not just give us our basic necessities in order to thrive and grow. So that's kind of what that little experiment reminds me of. If you hear anything in the background, Mercy's here with me. So you might hear him every once in a while pipe in with his comments on this story.
Hi.
He says hello. Anyway, getting back on topic, in the 15th century, King James IV of Scotland, of Scotland wanted to find out whether language was learned or innate. So he sent two children to be raised on a remote island by a mute woman. Some say they spoke Hebrew. Robert Lindsay wrote in his 1814 Chronicles of Scotland, he added that there was no proof that the boys ever did talk. Psychologist Harry Harlow studied infant monkeys and noticed that those raised without a mother were reclusive. They were socially defective and clung to cloth diapers. So in the 1950s, he started experimenting with the nature of nurturing. In one test, he put groups of baby monkeys in a room with two fake mothers. One was made of wire and gave out food. The other was made of terry cloth and had soft arms that it held out. Though the monkeys were hungry, they clung to the cloth, choosing comfort over nourishment. Harlow also isolated monkeys in cages, but allowed them to watch other monkeys. Soon the monkeys who were alone started staring blankly, circling their cages and self-mutilating. Oh, poor babies.
Yes.
He later isolated the monkeys entirely, some for as long as 15 years. Yeah, that's kind of mean. I mean, those poor monkeys, those poor babies. Now, no monkey has died during isolation, he wrote in a 1965 study. When initially removed from total isolation, however, they usually go into a state of emotional shock characterized by autistic self-clutching and rocking. One monkey, isolated for 3 months, refused to eat after being released and died 5 days later. Harlow wrote, the autopsy report attributed his death to emotional anorexia. Oh, that poor baby.
Poor baby. Now, if history does have a human evolution has taught us anything, is that the most humane trait is our ability to adapt. Though survival on his own planet has certainly gotten easier over time, these 9 stories of feral children remind us of our roots and the perils of life in the wild. Defined as a child who has lived in isolation from human contact from an early age, a feral child often struggles to learn the human language and behavior once they make the contact with people again. Now, while some feral children are able to make the progress, others struggle to even form a complete sentence. The phenomenon of feral children, is exceptionally rare, as they have now seen over 100 known cases throughout human history. Some of these stories show how malleable as we are as a species, while others reveal how vital human contact truly in our formative years. All of these cases, however, explore the resilience of humankind in the face of abandonment and being forced to fend for oneself. Look at Utsar Pradesh. He was raised by wolves in India. Oh, I'm sorry. Dina Shachar was the gentleman. He spent the first few years of his life thinking he was a wolf. It is believed he never learned how to interact with human beings until hunters found him in 1867 and took him to an orphanage. Thus, he spent years attempting to adapt to human behavior, which may have inspired Roger Kipling's The Jungle Book. But Shachar's story is no fairy tale. The hunters had first encountered Shachar at a wolf's den, where they were shocked to see a 6-year-old boy living among the pack. They decided it wasn't safe for the child to be out in the jungle. So they decided to transport him to civilization.
You know, it's interesting how this is, you know, inspired by the Jungle Book. A lot of times when we hear these stories, you know, we think of like, oh, this had to have been a movie or, you know, something of fiction that was written, a book or whatever. But it's mm-hmm. really, you know, interesting how this is actually history and these things really did happen, even though they were few and far between. Right. There has been some debate on whether this is, you know, if these children were really feral or if, you know, if it was a show or that was put on or kind of like a con. So that's where kind of like the debate comes in on it. However, once the hunters realized early on that they would have difficulty communicating with Sunny Chair, as he behaved much like a wolf, he would walk on all fours and only speak in wolf-like grunts and howls. Ultimately, the hunters smoked the pack out of the cave and killed. Oh man, they took the child back with them. Taken to Sikandra Mission Orphanage in the city of Agra, Sanchier was welcomed by the missionaries there. They gave him a name and observed his animal-like behavior. Even though he was no longer with the animals, he continued to walk on all fours and howl like a wolf. Sanichair would only accept raw meat as food and sometimes even chewed on the bones to sharpen his teeth, which was a skill he learned out in the wild. Before long, he became better known as the Wolf Boy. Though missionaries attempted to teach him sign language by pointing, it was soon clear that it would be a lost cause. After all, since wolves have no fingers, they aren't able to point at anything at all. So Sanichair likely had no idea what the missionaries were doing when they pointed their fingers.
Pointing with their fingers. That's kind of an interesting.
Yeah.
That said, Sanchir was able to make some progress while at the orphanage. He learned how to walk upright, put on his own clothes, and eat from a plate, although he sniffed his food before eating it. Perhaps the most human trait that he picked up, nasty habit, by the way, was smoking cigarettes. Despite all the strides he made, Sanchir never learned a human language or fully adjusted to life among other people in forages. He ultimately died of tuberculosis in 1895 when he was just 35 years old. Mm. Now, when it comes to feral children found in America, perhaps none of them has suffered much cruelty as Jeannie Wiley. Born in 1957 near Los Angeles, she endured horrific abuse from the hands of her father, Clark. For 13 years, Clark kept Jeannie isolated in a room with more akin to a prison cell. Most of the time, Jeannie was kept strapped to a toilet toddler toilet, and sometimes she even was placed in an actual cage. When Clark wasn't burying her with a plank of wood, he was growing her like a rabid dog.
Sounds like he had some issues himself.
Yes.
Oh, goodness. Most crucially, Jeannie had almost no interaction with anyone else but her immediate family during those formative years, and she was never allowed outside. Until her mother, Irene, escaped with her in 1970. Since Irene was nearly blind, she would later claim that her disability prevented her from helping Jeannie while her daughter was going through all of this. Shortly after fleeing the home, Irene accidentally walked into a Los Angeles social service office instead of an office that offered aid to the blind. Welfare workers took one look at Jeannie and immediately knew that there was help in need. At first, they thought she might simply be autistic, but then they learned the grim truth about the feral child. Cases of abuse were opened against both Jeannie's parents, but Irene was able to convince authorities to drop a case against her, claiming she was also a victim. As for Clark, he ended his life instead of facing trial, leaving behind a note that read, "The world will never understand." Yeah, I think he had some issues himself.
Yes.
It's such a tragedy.
Right. What the National Institute of Mental Health drastically wanted to understand, however, was how extreme isolation in a person's formative years shaped their lives. And a group of scientists were highly interested in finding out what part of the language has been a person's development and vice versa. They saw Jeannie as a blank slate, an opportunity for research. So from 1971 to 1975, Jeannie was subjected to scientific experimentations at the behest of the researchers. During this time, experts made some discoveries. For example, Jeannie disproved the theory that one could not learn a language after puberty. Puberty, not puberty.
Although, well, it is pretty poo-poo.
Yes, though she did struggle with grammar. However, many scientists felt the experimentation was too rigorous to be ethical. Many of the scientists were also accused of having a conflict of interest as she lived with them during the study. In 1979, her mother filed a lawsuit against the hospital and many of the scientists who had studied Jeannie, claiming that it exploited her for prestige and profit. The suit was settled in 1984, and Jeannie would cease to all contact with researchers.
Though Jeannie lived with her mother for a brief period, she was eventually placed in foster homes, some of which were not very kind either. These experiences caused her to regress, and she never recovered from the trauma, even when she was removed from the homes and reunited with her mother. While it is reported that she's still alive today and assisted living in Los Angeles, the 64-year-old is believed to be a mere shell of a person. So, yeah, just to let you all know, we don't condone this type of behavior. This is, you know, some of the darkest,
worst stuff that humans can do.
Yes, agreed. Now we go on to discovered naked and alone in the German wilderness in 1725. Peter, the wild boy, was about 11 years old when he was rescued. It's believed that he was abandoned by his parents, who likely couldn't afford to raise him. And after he was discovered, everyone called him Peter, but no one actually knew if that was his real name. Like many feral people left to fend for themselves, he was unable to talk, and he also hated wearing clothes. The following year, when Peter was about 12, he was transported to London, where he would become the human pet of King George I. Oh my goodness. There, the wild boy ran around on all fours and picked the pockets of courtiers in the Kensington Palace.
You're walking right over my line.
Oh, I apologize. Continue. Uh-huh. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just so lost into all of this, and it's like you've never mm-hmm. done it to me before. But go for it. Tell us more about Peter.
Yeah, Peter. It was widely believed that Peter had been raised by wolves or bears, as behavior made it clear he now spends time with people. In this age of enlightenment, it made Peter's condition all the more fascinating to English high society. And they questioned what it meant to be human. Meanwhile, many in the palace grew tired of Peter's antics, especially his poor table manners and his insistence on sleeping on the floor. Eventually, the court paid for Peter's retirement at a farm in Hertfordshire. He spent the rest of his life surrounded by kind farmers, but was forced to wear a collar that read, "Peter the Wild Man of Hanover. Whoever will bring him to Mr. Fem at Bethernstone shall be paid for their trouble."
Oh, goodness. Peter died in 1785 and was buried in the cemetery of St. Mary's at North Church. Since then, experts have used Peter's portraits and hypothesized that he had suffered from Pitt-Hopkins syndrome, which is a rare genetic condition that causes distinctive facial features as well as an intellectual disability. Tragically, that may explain why his parents abandoned him. In 2011, the condition that afflicted Peter, the wild boy, was suspected to be the chromosomal disorder, Pitt-Hopkins syndrome, a condition only identified in 1978, which was nearly 200 years after Peter's death. Various physical attributes of Peter's, which are evident in the Kensington Palace portrait, have been matched to this condition, such as his curvy Cupid bow lips, his short stature, his coarse curly hair, drooping eyelids, and thick lips. An item on the BBC Radio 4 program, Witness History, broadcast in March of 2011, examined the history of Peter the Wild Boy, tracing his life in North Church and later in Berkhamsted, where the leather and brass collar designed to identify Peter in case he should wander away from the village and inscribed Peter the Wild Man as preserved at Berkhamsted School. Ugh, that's a tongue twister.
Berkhamsted School?
Yes.
Now we go up, move up to about May 26, 1828, and go to Nuremberg, Germany, where residents encountered a 16-year-old boy in bedraggled clothing passing through a public square. The mysterious teenager appeared to be unable to read, write, or recall anything about his life except for his name was Kaspar Hauer. Now people do want to know all about Kaspar Hauer. Hauer carried two letters in the novel that initially seemed to clarify a few things. First, letter addressed the captain of a local cavalry and asked him to place the boy in his regiment. The second was dated 1812 and supposedly written by the boy's mother. It had explained that the boy's father had died and reiterated that Hauser must join the military. When authorities took Hauser into custody, they found him repulsed by all food and drink save for bread and water. Strangely, he also walked as though he only had just learned how to. And in the rare instance that he spoke, he mainly mumbled about horses. Made a ward of the city, Hauser was eventually put into custody of a British nobleman named Lord Stanhope. Incredibly, just weeks after his rescue, Hauser apparently learned how to read and write. He would later claim that he had been just raised in a small room without light until an unknown man guided him to the outskirts of Nuremberg. Right.
Shelley says, in many cultures, babies that were born less than perfect were left abandoned. Out to die.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if this is the case with some of these kids. I definitely agree. I do know also that a lot of times they were locked away in a room,
mm-hmm.
and hidden from society. So yeah, it's very, very sad what we did to people who were disabled or, you know, as she pointed out, less than perfect in our past. It's, oh, mankind, gotta love it.
Yes.
Now going back to Hauser, observed by the poet and professor George Friedrich Dahmer, Hauser began to reveal more shocking details about his upbringing. He explained that he had been brought up in a prison during his early years, but then also mentioned a detailed dream that involved him living in a castle. Huh, so it seems like he was a man of tall tales.
Yes.
Some residents who believe that Hauser was a true feral person and savant speculated that he may have actually been a lost prince, or perhaps even the son of Stephanie de Beauharnais or Beauharnais. Always have trouble with French. Meanwhile, others simply thought that he was a fraud who was after fame and fortune. Yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards that.
Yeah.
However, to this day, Hauser's true identity remains unknown. But one thing that is known is that he suffered a painful death. In his final years, there were many alleged attempts on his life by strange men, culminating in a fatal stabbing in 1833. However, some insisted that he had stabbed himself just for attention, only to accidentally wound himself far more gravely than he had intended. While it is clear that Hauser enjoyed attention from others and almost certainly exaggerated his story, you think? Many still debate whether he was a talented con artist or a true feral person with a severe mental illness. Illness.
He had a severe mental illness because I have cute sense of airing.
About 200 years later, we still don't have the full answers and likely never will. I vote con artist.
That's what I'm saying. Right.
Yes.
So let's go ahead and go back just a little bit to 1731 to the village of Songy, France. Villagers spotted a young girl dressed in animal's rags stealing apples from an orchard. It was difficult for the villagers to tell how old she is, and her age was estimated to be anywhere from 10 to 18 years old.
That's a pretty wide range.
Yeah. You know, when the villagers did send a bulldog her way, she killed it with one fatal blow and escaped in the woods in mere moments.
Wow.
Yeah, the villagers
are strong.
Yeah. The villagers eventually captured her and soon realized she didn't speak any formal language. Instead, she communicated much more like an animal, often howling. So she was hospitalized in Chalons. She was baptized as Marie Angelique Menet Leblanc. With that, doctors and other experts immediately moved towards civilizing her. The feral children origins was only revealed in 1755 when biographer Marie Catherine Omasse-Hiquet published her American account of a savage girl in collaboration with LeBlanc. A Native American girl, LeBlanc had allegedly been painted black and sold as a slave in Wisconsin at the age of 7. Sold to a French woman, LeBlanc was put on a French-bound ship.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they took this poor girl.
Mm-hmm.
And painted her.
Right.
And then sold her into slavery when she was 7.
Uh-huh.
I mean, couldn't people tell that she wasn't? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, you know. Many believe that the boat in question, sorry, I don't know if you heard that loud car going by, they drive like crazy right here. Many believe that the boat in question was shipwrecked and LeBlanc was washed ashore with another girl. From there, they both became feral people and slept in the wilderness, surviving on raw squirrel, foxes, and rabbits. At some point, the pair separated and LeBlanc was eventually captured. Despite her traumatic start to life, LeBlanc would eventually regain her health while in the hospital. Even more incredible, she soon learned to speak French under the tutelage of several patient teachers, apparently regaining linguistic abilities that had been lost for quite some time. She was gawked at by intellectuals and high society people in France as a former savage, quote-unquote, who had become refined. Mingling with nobility, LeBlanc was given a generous allowance by a duke and permitted to explore Europe. For a brief period of time, she even tried her hand at becoming a nun.
While the duke's death in 1752 left LeBlanc without financial resources, she soon was able to secure other patronages thanks to her numerous wealthy connections. By the time she died at the age of 63 in 1775, she was notably wealthy herself. It was said she preferred to wear silk and velvet clothing, and yet she still maintained a certain wildness in her appearance.
How did they know she was 63 when she died, when they couldn't figure out her age when she was found? They said she was either between the ages of 10 and 18. So how do they know her exact age when she died?
No, because they just decided to say, oh, she was 63 when she died. Maybe when she learned how to talk, she's like,
I was born in 1904, you know, and I'm kind of reverse type of thing, you know.
Okay, so she was born in 1904, but she was found in 1752.
Exactly. She stepped through that hidden portal through time.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. Howard and I were just like this. I was the one over here.
Okay.
In 1994, a feral child was discovered living among the wild dogs in the village of Nova Blaskovichka. Nova Blakovochenichka in Ukraine. Local police had never dealt with feral humans before, and they had to use food in order to distract the hounds while they lured the young girl away from her canine family. I'll say family instead of friends, you know. The 8-year-old was eventually identified as Oksana Malaysia, a local girl whose alcoholic parents had abandoned her outside in the cove for 5 years earlier.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, instinctively, Malaya had crawled into a dog kennel to seek warm shelter and spent the next 5 years with its inhabitants. Sustained by whatever scraps or leftovers the canines were fed, Malaya have occasionally entered her old house for additional food. But undoubtedly, she lived a large feral life outdoors until the police were called.
You know, that's really interesting that she was able to survive, because it gets really cold in the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know they have some very, very harsh winters and below zero. So for her to be able to live through that by, you know, these dogs keeping her warm, that's just, you know, really amazing that happened. But as a ward of the state, Malaya was admitted to several psychiatric institutes and group homes. For a while, she was unable to speak and continued to walk on all fours. But Malaya eventually learned how to talk again, thanks to the minimal language she already knew from her early years. At an orphanage school, she was successfully taught a more wide-ranging vocabulary. She also learned how to walk upright again and to communicate like other human beings, at least for the most part. Though Malaya is now in her late 30s, she still requires supervision and adult care, at an adult care facility, and she will likely never be fully independent. She is also said to speak in a flat, emotionless tone, almost as if she's being ordered to talk. But her bark remains as strong as ever. And whenever she gets given an object, her very first instinct is to hide it, just like a dog does with a bone. I wouldn't want to ask about her bite then.
No, because most feral humans have been abandoned against their will. Ivan Mikoskov, found living in the streets, preamble to his life at home. He had a difficult childhood in the care of an alcoholic grandfather who commonly left the boy on his own for days on end. At the age of 3 or 4, young boy left his home to find refuge with the stray dogs in the mid-1990s. Russians and Ukrainians, my gosh. The homeless boy and his companions beg for food from local bakeries in town near Moscow. In the cold of night, Meshkov curled up with a pack of dogs in order to fall asleep. He named the dogs Jesse, Groga, Masha, and Seva, and spent about 2 years with them. The hounds had grown to accept that Meshkov as one of their own and shared whatever scraps they found on the street with him. Meshkov returned the favor, but then the police rescued him in 1998. This took several tries, as the protective dogs wouldn't allow anyone near Meshkov at first. By the time Meshkov was saved, he was about 5 or 6 years old and clear of the need of help. Still, he was reluctant to leave the dogs that they had bonded with. "I love my dogs, and they loved me," Mishka said. "They gave me a lick on the face, that the dog cannot give kisses." Mishov soon placed into an orphanage near Moscow. His loyal canine family never forgot him, however, and appeared at the institution's gates to retrieve him. Unfortunately, local officials decided to kill the dogs, which Mishov describes as his only family. Come on, people.
Why did they kill the dogs? Why didn't they just let him keep them?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. This is... Now, I understand that if it wasn't for the dogs, I would have survived in the streets, said Mushukov. But I am also grateful to the policeman who took me from the pack and, of course, to my foster mom who raised me. Mushkov's fortune certainly changed when Tatiana Babanina took him in. The loving foster mother not only helped him recover from his traumatizing youth, but also ensured that he excelled academically. After graduating from Kronstadt Naval Cadet School, he found a full-time factory job. Unlike many other feral people, his story has been mostly a happy ending, except for his poor puppies. Sorry.
Yes. We won't talk about that.
No, we won't. Many feral children on this list had traumatizing youths, and Marina Chapman is no exception. According to Chapman, she was kidnapped at the age of 4, only to be abandoned in the jungles of Colombia in the 1950s. She remembers being left for dead, only to encounter a group of monkeys that cautiously allowed her to join their family.
Monkeys. As chronicalized in her autobiography, The Girl with No Name, she began to follow the roaming family of primates around, wordlessly leading her to fruits and nuts. They ultimately accepted her as one of them. Ultimately, however, she learned some of the tougher laws of the jungle. "They don't give you anything," said Chapman. "You just have to wait until something drops, and then you have to move quickly, because if you don't want, another monkey will take it away." Yeah. It's worth noting that her story has been difficult to prove or disprove, with some naysayers saying she's making the whole thing up. But, as Chapman tells it, she lived with the monkeys for about 5 years. At the age of 9, she finally garnered the courage and curiosity to approach people in the jungle, only to be captured and forced into sexual slavery in a nearby town. While she was eventually able to escape and soon found herself on the streets with limited vocabulary.
Oh my goodness. She said, "I quickly learned with children to speak when I came to the city, but with adults, I found them difficult to understand. With monkeys, you know where you stand with them. But with humans, it's complicated." Yeah, I can definitely agree. Chapman had no problem stealthily finding food and nimbly evading onlookers. But she was tired of merely surviving. So she accepted a job as a household servant in an attempt to properly support herself. However, when she overheard her employer discussing a murder, she realized that she was working for ruthless gangsters and was forced to escape yet again. Yeah, I can believe that in Colombia. There's some stuff that goes down there that's not very kind. While her book led several critics to try and debunk her story, they have yet to do so. Even her publisher ordered Chapman to be evaluated for false memory syndrome, which she didn't display. Amazingly, she is now a happy grandmother living in the United Kingdom today. Though she mostly lives in a relatively normal life now, she did teach her children how to climb trees early on and make monkey noises at the breakfast table.
Still, Chapman doesn't believe her story is that unusual. Despite the jaw-dropping details, I was really surprised because, believe me, I spent some time with some children on the streets, and they had so many stories to tell that I don't think mine was anything special, she said. Unlike many other feral children, Marcos Rodriguez Banjoya ended up in the wild by mistake. His father had sold him to the farmer when he was just 6 or 7 years old. Banjoya was then instructed to help an aging goat herd in the Sierra Morena Mountains of Spain. Eventually, the man who Pedro was working for died and was forced to make the decision on what to do next. Since he had grown up in an abusive home, he did want to return to his family. So he chose to stay in the mountains by himself. Surviving on his own, the feral person spent the next 12 years of his life surrounded by wolves and other animals like goats, bears, and snakes. Remarkably, he found natural shelter inside the caves, where the wolves offered him their food. But the wolves weren't the only ones helping him out.
The animals guided him as to what to eat. Whatever they ate, he ate. The wild boars ate tubers buried under the soil. They found them because they smelled them. When they were digging the soil looking for them, I threw a stone at them. Then I would steal the tubers. Oh, that's just mean.
Yeah.
Luckily, the goat herd had taught Pantoja how to hunt rabbits and build traps out of sticks and leaves before he died. This turned out to be invaluable, as he didn't always have other animals around to teach him to go after food. But when he did, Pantoja eventually learned how to communicate with the creatures by using growls and other sounds instead of words. But in 1965, Pantoja was found by the Guardia Civil, who forcibly took him into the village of Fuencaliente. There, he was briefly reunited with his father, who simply asked him what happened to the jacket he had on when he left. Okay, so his dad was more concerned about the jacket than finding his son. Meanwhile, Pantoja was forced to learn how to communicate like a human again. And so he decided to tell his story to anyone who would listen, turning him into a local legend of the area. Eventually, he took a Spanish anthropologist. Yes, thank you. Eventually, a Spanish anthropologist named Gabriel Janer Manila.
No. It's Spanish.
Oh, so it's
Gabriel
Janer Manila.
Manila, yes.
Took interest in his history. I am sorry.
Manuela.
Manila.
Manila wrote a thesis on the case, published a novel about Pañola's life, and filmed him 10 years after he had just returned from the wild. Though Manila was initially skeptical of Pajero's story, he soon found it remained consistent for years. In addition, locals who had made interactive with Padilla shortly after he was found corroborated many of his claims. Despite his unusual start of life, Pañola eventually assimilated himself in human society again. Under the tutelage of nuns who taught him manners and society customs, he learned how to live on his own in Granada, Spain. That said, Pañola had missed feeling about his return to civilization as he often felt disappointed by many humans in his life. And even though now in his 70s, he sometimes wishes that he can return to the wild. Now, let's talk about the legend of the Green Children of Woolpit. They start during the reign of King Stephen in a rather tumultuous time in English history called the Anarchy in the mid-12th century.
Yes, this will definitely be a little more lightened than some of the other stories.
Mm-hmm.
But Woolpit, or in Old English, Woolpit, is an ancient village in Suffolk, named after, as one might gather from its name, an old pit of catching wolves. These pits, designed to lure and ensnare dangerous wolves, were likely at least twice as tall as children and a couple of hundred square feet in the area. Next to the wolf pit, around 1150, a group of villagers came across two young children who had green skin, apparently speaking gibberish and acting nervously. The children, found to be brother and sister, were of generally normal appearance except for the color of their skin, which was green. And they spoke in an unknown language. According to the writings at the time by Ralph of Cogshall, the children were subsequently taken to the nearby home of Sir Richard de Calne, where he offered them food, but they repeatedly refused to eat. This continued for some days until the children came across some green beans in Richard de Calne's garden, which they ate straight out of the ground. Eventually, they learned to eat other foods and lost their green color. But the boy was sickly and continued to suffer. He could not adapt to the environment and soon became ill, dying. The girl adjusted to her new life, and after she learned to speak English, the girl explained that she and her brother had come from a land where the sun never shone and the light was like twilight. The sun does not rise up on our countrymen, and our land is little cheered by its beams. We are contented with that twilight, which among you precedes the sunrise or follows the sunset. Moreover, a certain luminous country is seen not far distant from ours and divided by a very considerable river. So my thought is that these kids are green because all they ate were green vegetables.
Mm-hmm. That might have been.
So the not chloroform, but...
Chlorophyll.
Chlorophyll. They had a lot of chlorophyll in their system because it says that when they started eating regular food, that green tint went away. So I'm thinking they were just some feral kids who lived off of green vegetables.
Right. The children were unable to account for when their arrival in Woolpit. They had been herding their father's cattle when they heard a loud noise. It was like the sounds of bells of St. Edmund's Abbey, and suddenly found themselves by the wolf pit where they were found. Ralph says they became lost when they followed the cattle into a cave, after being guided by the sound of bells, and eventually emerged into our land. The girl, who was employed many years as a servant in Richard de Calne's household, where she considered to be a very wanton and impudent. She eventually married a man from King's Lynn, about 45 miles from Woolpit, where she was still living. Based on her research into Richard de Calne's family history, it is concluded that the girl was given the name Agnes, and she married a royal official named Richard Barry. According to one report, the pair had at least one child. If this story is based on actual events, there are a few plausible explanations for the green tint. One theory is that the children had arsenic poisoning. The story goes that their caretaker, an Earl of Norfolk, left them to die in the forest near the Norfolk-Suffolk border. Another more likely and less depressing culprit is chloriosis, a type of iron deficiency spawned by malnutrition that leads to a greenish complexion. So that kind of sounds really interesting.
Yes. And then Another and perhaps most likely theory postulates that they were children of Flemish immigrants who were persecuted and killed, possibly in the battle at Forum in 1173. Forum St. Martin was a nearby village separated from Woolpit by a river just a few miles from the Bury St. Edmunds, where loud bells often chimed. It's possible that the children had been orphaned, suffered a poor diet while lost on their own, and eventually made their way to Woolpit from Foreham, St. Martin, by following the clanging bells. Historian Charles Oman noted that one element of the children's account, the entry into a different reality by way of a cave, seems to have been quite popular. Gerard of Wells, the medieval historian, tells a similar story of a boy who was a truant from school who encountered two pygmies who led him through an underground passage into a beautiful land with fields and rivers, but not lit by the full light of the sun. Your underground people you're always talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Gervais,
I believe.
You firmly believe in the people that live underground?
Yep.
Well, you know, we do have many caverns and cave systems that have never been discovered or
right.
even, you know, ventured through. So who knows? Gervase of Tilbury, whom Ralph of Cockshall is known to have been acquainted, also wrote of a Derbyshire swineherder who looked for a pig in a cave but found a world where the seasons were the other way around. So I guess basically what they're saying is that these caves lead to alternate dimensions or
possibly
different like portals or wormholes to other lands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know how much I buy into that, but I go for the either the malnutrition or eating too many green vegetables. I mean, you eat too many carrots, you turn orange. So
yeah.
So, continue.
Continue. Now, from an escaping divorce behind the Woolpit children is that they were hailed from European background and had a reverence for the Christian church and subsided through farming's livestock. They knew about tending to cattle that they likely had been taught to their father. Regardless of their strange clothes and language they spoke, historians believe that they may have been Flemish immigrants escaping the persecution of King Henry II. Dressed in strange Flemish clothes and speaking another language, they will appear to be strange to the very English-speaking villages of Woolpit. The eating of beans has also attracted a lot of folklorists. It is to be noticed, too, that the habitual food of children were beans. The food of the dead, of course. There are others who don't buy this explanation and say they're either travelers from a parallel dimension of time or came from a mysterious underground world that's not known to mankind yet. Robert Burton suggested in a 1621 book, The Anatomy of Melancholy, that the green children fell from heaven, leading others to speculate that the children may only have been extraterrestrials. They're aliens, man! Trust me!
Are they extraterrestrials or are they intraterrestrials? That's the question.
Yes.
Are they from another, are they from out there or from down there?
Yes.
In 1996, an article published in the magazine Analog, astronomer Duncan Lunan hypothesized that the children were accidentally transported to Woolpit from their home planet, which may be trapped in synchronous orbit around its sun, presenting the conditions for life only in a narrow twilight zone between a fiercely hot surface and a frozen dark side. The story of the green children has endured for over eight centuries since the first recorded accounts, while the real facts behind the true story may never be known. and has been provided through inspiration for numerous poems, novels, operas, and plays around the world, and continues to capture the imagination of many curious minds. So, now we ask you, the viewer or listener, what are your thoughts on the feral children? What are your thoughts on the green children? Do you think that they were aliens from another dimension or just malnourished children? Leave us a comment. And if you are watching on YouTube, make sure you like and subscribe. If you're listening to a replay on your favorite podcast, we ask that you rate us and leave a review. And what kind of reviews do we like?
We like a 1, we like a 2, we like a 3, like a 4, we like a 5 stars there on the Apple.
We do like...
Tell us how good we're doing or bad we're doing.
Yes, we definitely like 5 stars, but we'll take what you can give us. Also, make sure you leave a review. We do read reviews on air, so it's a good way to get a shout out. Also, if you have any comments or questions, you can also email us at info@skepticpsychic.com. Mm-hmm. If you have anything that you would like to share as far as stories you would like us to read on air or any ideas for the show, such as different topics you would like to hear us cover, you can email us there as well. Again, that's info@skepticpsychic.com, and you can find that on our website. We did get a message from Shelley, our wonderful researcher, and we appreciate all the work she did on this episode. She says, I wonder if they wore the clothing that they wore was dyed green, and if that could have stained their skin.
Maybe.
That is an interesting hypothesis. I hadn't thought about that one. Also,
living in a cave, man.
They were just covered in moss and mildew. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
But I do wanted also to say how, like, our generation was also known as the feral generation, because, you know, we had the latchkey kids and the going out and being out until the lights came on. Our parents rarely knew where I was, where we were. So people say that we were feral. Do you agree with that statement? Would you say you were a feral child growing up?
I was a real wild child.
You were a real wild child.
Oh, yeah. Iggy Pop sang my national anthem.
Ah. Now Mercy agrees back here. He's going woohoo. So, yep. Yeah. But again, you know, if you think that the Generation X was, you know, definitely a feral generation, you can also, you know, leave a comment on that and share what your experience was growing up in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And if you feel like you were definitely a real wild child, as Richard has pointed out. And with that, I say sweet dreams, everybody. Have a great night.
And unpleasant nightmares.
Good night, everyone. Have a good one.
You too. Good night.